Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Bukhari Sellers Podcast. Today, we'll be interviewing none other than iconic journalist and anchor Soledad O'Brien, where we'll be talking about media and journalism and how we can combat misinformation. But before we get to Soledad, I wanted to join in celebrating today's signing of the Investment in Infrastructure and Jobs Act, nearly $2 trillion investment in our roads, bridges, broadband, and water infrastructure, just to name a few types of investment. This is a very, very good thing. And I don't want the wrangling over how we got here or the obstructionism around the president's social spending bill to cause people to lose sight of the fact that Donald Trump can get this done. And for the Biden-Harris administration, that's the second major piece of legislation they passed after being in office just over a year, where we passed the American Rescue Plan soon after taking office. If we can get Build Back Better across the line, that would be almost $6 trillion across the three bills, way bigger than the New Deal or the Great Society, making Joe Biden arguably the most transformative domestic president of our time. But if you let tracking polls and cable news tell that inflation and approval ratings have Joe Biden pulling at historic lows for the new president. And that's the disconnect I hope this White House closes in 2022 when election season is in full swing. We've got to make sure that the money actually hits the streets as quickly as possible. But the sales jobs around what this all means for the American people has to not only be done by the president and vice president, but please activate surrogates and other folks like me who can talk about these bills in real terms and make the case in clear terms why Democratic vote usually means something. I know we've all had moments of disappointment on a number of issues, but we're actually passing bills, y'all. This isn't a small feat, and it's something that Donald Trump couldn't do even when he had a Republican Congress to do it. Let's not let the reporting around the horse race have folks lose sight of the wins right now that are right in front of our faces. And that's that on that. Now on to our show with Soledad O'Brien.
This episode is brought to you by Major League Baseball. A lot is going on in the world of sports right now, but don't forget the 2024 baseball season. It's officially here. Some pretty exciting things to look forward to. Can the star-studded Dodgers, can they make the World Series? Can Mookie Betts break my heart again? How about the young Orioles? How about the defending champs, the Rangers, trying to become the first back-to-back champs in over two decades? See how far they'll go. Get in on the action by visiting your local ballpark or any ballpark, or you can just go to MLB.com, tap the banner to learn more. Baseball is something else. This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real-life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower What's Next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client.
This is actually an infrastructure week that is coming to fruition, maybe. So tell me this. How are you feeling today? What's going on in your world? What's new? Welcome to the Bukhari Sellers Podcast. I'm glad you took some time to hang out with me.
Yeah, I love it. It's nice to see you. I've been moving. I lived in Chelsea for 24 years, and packing up 24 years of stuff with four kids is basically a circle of hell. And we moved uptown to Harlem. And so it's been really, it's very, very different and very residential. And I love it so far, but I've only been here about a week. So that's been nice. And then we're working on a bunch of projects that are about to launch. So that's been a little crazy as well. So, you know, moving while you also are giving birth to a documentary is so easy.
And we'll get into some of those projects. You know, we usually start each one of our episodes by having our guest walk us through the arc of their careers. And while people definitely know who you are, I don't think most people appreciate just how many different things you've done. So if you don't mind, can you walk our listeners through the arc of your career from your first reporting gig, doing medical reporting in Boston, to the work you do now for your production company, Starfish Media Group?
Yeah. So I started in 1987. I was an intern. And so it's been like 34 years that I've been actually doing this. And it was such an interesting time back then. We had one guy who did live shots. Like, live shots weren't a thing. There was one truck and one guy. What's his name? I can see him, but I can't remember his name. And most reporters didn't. They filed stories. And that would, of course, change very dramatically by the time I got to cable news. And I started there at the same time. I was an intern and a production assistant. I started working on this radio show doing medical stories. And then I kind of kept working my way up. I loved doing TV news. So I was an associate producer, went to NBC News to become a researcher and producer for Bob Bazell, who was a medical reporter at NBC for a long time. And one of my jobs was to carry the cell phone, because back in the day, in the early 90s, 1991, cell phones were literally like, imagine two bricks glued together. And one of my jobs was to carry them around in case someone needed a cell phone. By the way, that thing was heavy. Then I went to start reporting at KRON TV in San Francisco. Left there to take a job when MSNBC launched in 1996. I did a tech show called The Site. And then when that show got canceled after about a year and a bit, I came back to New York and started working on the Weekend Today Show, and then started anchoring the Weekend Today Show. And then I left NBC and NBC stations for CNN. I left in 2003 and stayed there till about 2013. Mm-hmm. And then in 2013, I jumped in order to start my own production company. And so the through line really is I did a lot of the same kinds of work. I'd say, continuing to expand and expand and expand, but always kind of trying to get a little uncomfortable and trying to add, I guess, to my resume, doing the things that I hadn't really had a chance to do before. Often there's a lot of pushback, I think, when you want to do something different or just something you haven't done. But I have really found it very rewarding to kind of strike out. You learn a lot. You learn a lot about yourself. You learn a lot about whatever you want to do. And I think it opens a lot of doors.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute, because your career transition is one that many people are somewhat going through now. You went from a reporter to being in the content business, which we know now is absolutely everything. So why did you make that transition?
We used to call that reporting back in the day, but now I create content.
You're an influencer. You're the OG influencer. How about that? A lot of folks, particularly younger folks, they talk about being the talent, right? And my question to you is, what are the benefits of going from being the talent to actually being able to control the power and the money and the content that's being created that you do now so well?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, I think there's benefits to both. I mean, what I've liked about being the talent, before I was the talent, I was a producer, and I would give information to the talent. And then the talent, who was a dear friend of mine and a great reporter, but he would do with it what he wanted to. The stories, right, the things that stuck out, he got to pick. And very rarely would I say, oh, I would have done that differently. He had a great scientific mind. So often his stories led with the scientists, where I was often very compelled to lead with the families that were often dealing with some kind of crisis. And so you sit there and think like, well, if I were to do this, I'd do it a little bit differently. So one real upside of being the talent is that you get to decide. I loved anchoring shows because you get to decide the questions. You get to decide the framing. And as you well know, framing is everything. Framing is a lot in politics. Framing is a lot in TV news. How we think about shaping the story is everything. And when you're the anchor, you really get to shape the story. On the other hand, I do think, being able to be responsible for the content as a producer, as an executive producer, a lot of the work I do now is that. And I love it. I love being able to help something get across the finish line. It's a very different role, but it's important too, because, without all those other people, that stuff just doesn't happen. And so that's been pretty exciting as well, without being the talent, which is, I like that a lot as well. I like being the talent just a little bit.
Being as someone who is the talent, it is cool. But sometimes you do wish you could dictate the stories or tell more stories. I was looking at a story today, a news story that's not going to get covered anywhere, but they noted it was 3,000 individuals who have died so far in Ethiopia's civil war. And I'm like, man, I haven't seen that anywhere. And this is the work that we do. And I wish we were able to tell those stories. Before we get to Matter of Fact or the special you're doing on Rosa Parks or Black and Missing, which is just timely, and we'll get into that, I want to talk about your takes on journalism. Even the Pope today. The Pope was telling
journalists how to do their jobs. Pope's like, let me help you, people who are clearly struggling.
The Pope was like tweeting like Soledad. I was like, what is it?
He curses less than I do. He's much better about it. I curse all the time. Yeah. I find political journalists extremely frustrating at this moment, because it's sort of like watching a game where people are being worked and they know they're being worked and they just can't figure out how to get out of the relationship they're in where they're being worked. And so they keep going down the primrose path because back to framing, right? You realize you're in it. Your people, a good example, the Washington Post today printed an opinion piece about critical race theory.
And they misquoted Martin Luther King Jr.
Completely wrong. And not only misquoted him, but also really misunderstood, again, the entire framework of what Dr. King felt about structural racism, where, you know, he was pretty clear on it, talked about it a lot, wrote about it a lot.
He won a Nobel Peace. He won a Nobel Peace Prize because of it.
He won some stuff for it, you know, and you realize like, wow, there's no one. What they did was they gave an opportunity. They elevated a person who was just wrong, completely. It wasn't a matter of opinion. What he said was just factually incorrect about Dr. King. But now he's, you know, now people will quote him and now the lie that Dr. King, you know, would have been against critical race theory or whatever his point of his stupid op-ed piece was. So, you know, things like that are just a massive fail. It's a fail.
Let me ask you a very, very specific question. What did the mainstream media get wrong about covering Trump and Trumpism? Because that still is out there. And do you think, I mean, I giving credit sometimes is difficult. Have they gotten any better since 2016?
I think the game's changed since 2016. So I don't know. I think you can really feel the media pining away for Donald Trump because conflict sells and it feels good to be debating and arguing. Listen, every single reporter, when Trump would insult them, what would they do? They would take that quote and it became their profile on their profile page on social media. Right? He's the worst journalist in the world, Donald Trump. Right? I mean, so what does that tell you about how this person feels about what they're doing? You know, it's you could be just horrified, but instead it's sort of amusing, it's funny, it's a game. And I think that was one of the lessons or the takeaways you saw in a lot of the coverage, that this entire thing is a game, that a lot of these policy issues, or even some of the terrible things that the President Trump at the time would say, they didn't feel them. They didn't think they were awful. Calling them something a shithole country didn't matter to them. They're not from Africa. They don't know any Africans. They're never going to go to Africa, you know? And so I feel like, or Haiti or wherever he's referring to. And, you know, and I think for a lot of people, it was very hurtful, but I think for a lot of journalists, it was just funny. It was a punchline. It was a joke. And I think a lot of them really treated things that were bigoted and racist that way. So one, I think they miss him because being constantly in outrage. Oh, can you believe what he said next? It's a little bit like watching The Real Housewives, right? Like, oh my God, did you see? She pulled her weave. Oh my goodness, that was crazy. It's a little bit like that, number one. And then of course, as you well know, false equivalence. Well, he did this. He did, you know, there is, some things are factual and some things are not. Elevating things where people who are liars are able to get a platform on shows like Meet the Press and Face the Nation. Yep. That's appalling to me. So there's numerous mistakes, but I get it because we're in a world dominated by social media. And what TV news really needs are those eyeballs and those clicks. And so you have to kind of gin up to some degree outrage over the topness, which I recognize is not a word, but it needs to be emotional and over the top and dramatic. And one way to do that is to talk about outrageous things that maybe even the article itself doesn't really say or has a more nuanced approach to. But, you know, this is social media. That's what you're competing with.
How did you settle into this role as, I don't want to call you a critic, but as someone who evaluates very publicly and utilizes your platform to call out media when they have strayed away from what you feel to be and what is probably accurate, what journalism truly is? Because you've settled into that role quite nicely over the last 5 years.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's very freeing when you don't work for, when you're not beholden, when you work for yourself. You know, I don't have a social media policy that I have to hit and make sure that I don't say anything, you know, I better not say anything mean about Meet the Press because that would be terrible. That, you know, where the number of journalists, by the way, who call me and they're like, oh my God, you're so right. I have these conversations all the time, but you know, he's a colleague. He's a friend. As someone said to me once, I like being on Meet the Press. I will never say anything bad about it because I get to be a guest occasionally and I like it. Mm. Well, you know, I mean, listen, you can't fault the guy for telling you honestly. I was like, yes, very revealing, but also very honest because some people I don't think are so honest. And if that means that, you know, you keep your mouth shut and you're going to get on, then so be it. Right. So to me, I don't have an interest on that. I've done a lot of those things already. I've had a really great career and great experiences. And what I want to do is in a different vein. So it doesn't feel like particularly risky. It doesn't feel particularly difficult. It just feels like, you know, here's what I'd like to highlight and point out for people who I think see it already. I think a lot of people outside of journalism, they understand that. They really do see, they do see it.
You know, one of those specific questions that I wanted to ask you was about our vice president. She's gotten back from a whirlwind trip to France, where by all accounts, I mean, they were comparing her visit to when Senator Obama, not even President Obama, went to France, to Paris to visit. But she comes back and she lands, and there's three stories, one on CNN, one in the Washington Post, and the other in Politico, just lambasting her and talking about the dysfunction. And I think I compared it this morning when I was on air on CNN to the way that the media treated Hillary Clinton. Do you see this same type of, it's like we're watching a car wreck in the way the media covers Kamala Harris. How do you evaluate the way the media covers the first female vice president and the first woman of color vice president?
Yeah, I think it's pretty interesting. Maggie Haberman of the New York Times the other day was talking about trolls. And she said, you know, just notice who trolls pick on. Very much, you know, woe is us. We are the victims here, which is often a sort of a stand of the New York Times. You know, we're the victims here. But actually, you know, I think they're they're often the first to pile on certainly political coverage. And yeah, I'm not surprised. And what happens is there's someone who's willing to say something, and that becomes the story. And they, you know, the timing is exactly right. It's not a surprise to me. She's a Black woman. I'm sure there are people in the administration, maybe even on her own team, who don't think she should be running for president, who don't like her. You know, as you know, I think women get judged very differently than men when it comes to leadership and in every which way. So I'm not surprised, but I think I always am surprised that the media falls for it over and over again. But again, you know, I think Politico is terrible. So Politico is going to do that kind of trash all the time.
Politico is sold now. They're an offshoot of they're gone. Let's talk about,
like, by the way, no surprise there, right? It's kind of like what I was telling you guys for a long time.
So let's talk about Matter of Fact. Talk to people about what it is. I've actually been on the show. It's a fascinating show. You actually get time to talk on the show. You
know, the show has been really fun. We started by having elected officials on, and we were in DC. And because we were pre-tape, we usually would tape on Thursdays. The show would air in some markets on Sunday. It seemed a little unfair, especially when Trump was president, because things would move so fast. You know, so you could say something on Thursday, and by Sunday, it was utterly irrelevant. The whole world had changed. And so we started, you know, interviewing fewer and fewer politicians, because I also felt like they were grandstanding quite a bit as opposed to people. Like, so I was like, you know, if we're going to talk about policies that affect homeless people, crazy idea. Why don't we go find some homeless people and actually ask them what they think? You know, and so we started interviewing people. You're in a book. That's why we had you on. We had, you know, people who were talking about poverty, people talking about lack of housing, people were talking about they're a millennial and they don't want to vote. You know, we, instead of getting the representative who represents their district, we would actually just go to them. And I think it made the show much more interesting and much more useful to understand how people are thinking, whether you agreed with them or not, because I think often politicians yell at each other and they're not really mad. They're actually just posturing. And so I think going to the actual source, you found people who didn't always agree, but they seem much more genuine in how they believed issues to be. So I, you know, we look at our show as trying to educate people. There's this issue. Let's help you understand it. There's a lot of stuff that's complicated about it. Let's walk through it and help you understand it. But I think a lot of times news now is people yelling at each other. Or again, why would you elevate something that's not true just because it's out there if it's going to confuse your audience? I mean, I would never give a platform to a person who's going to talk to me about how the earth is flat. The earth is not flat. So just the answer is no. Someone who's a climate change, you know, climate science denier. So like, we're not going to give a platform to that. That is just way outside of how scientists think about what's happening right now. So we're very careful about that. And our goal is to explain to people what's happening in their world so they can understand it better. Show's been really successful. We actually grew our audience. I mean, I was shooting a show during the pandemic from my bedroom and my twin boys, who are now, they were 16 at the time, they're now 17. They were the most miserable photographers you could ask for. They hated doing it, but they shot the show for me, but they loathed every
I didn't know those were, I didn't know those were your,
oh, those two little,
is there a labor law attorney? Did they get paid, compensated fairly for this? Cause if not, we're going to get you.
Actually they sent them a hat They got a hat. So then I had to compensate them myself because I thought they'd lose it. Listen, you know what? Although they were fed in food is what I did say. Like, oh, are you eating tonight? Because it sounds like it's fair. Do you sleep? Are you sleeping outside? Or are you going to sleep inside? Well, on your?
They told me that they will take a Tesla and they would only get one so they can share it. Just the FYI. Well,
their driving test is at the end of the month. So how about we pass a driving test first? I don't know. And then
cart, horse, you know, who cares? Whatever.
I think I can work on a Volkswagen, maybe, possibly, if they're well behaved, that they can share with their older sisters. The show has been really fun because I think we think very carefully. And the other thing that we do is, you know, our tagline is as diverse as America itself. And I think what's really helpful is to say, you know, if we're going to talk about the price of soybeans, then, you know, we're going to talk to a farmer. And ask, I don't know anything about soybeans. Have them explain what is happening. What is it? How do they feel about issues? So I have really enjoyed one that we go to the source. Two, we got rid of screaming politicians, which I thought was a lot of fakery anyway. And then number three, we're constantly looking at diversity. Like, who do we have on the air? And I know some people think about like, oh, diversity, wink, wink, means Black people. But to me, diversity is just, it's a diverse country.
It's diverse thought. Yeah.
And just, you know, a lot of different stories with different people. And I think we track it. We keep a little spreadsheet of everybody who's on the air. And we make sure that when we fail or we're struggling, I am so biased toward 60-year-old white dude economists, literally. The only economist I'm always like, oh, he'd be a great person to put on the air. 65-year-old white dude economist. Love that guy. I don't know why. And my executive producer will often be like, you know, there's lots of women economists.
I know. We got to get Cecilia Rouse. That's who she is.
We now have a bunch of female economists. Good. This is kind of early on. But, you know, you have to recognize in yourself, like, wow, I'm skewed one way. And how do we fix it? Because we really created what we wanted to create. It was the first time I'd had a conversation about diversity. We co-produced the show with Hearst, where people... It wasn't like wink, wink, you know, like, listen, diversity, but you know, what we're really going to do is blah, blah, blah. It was like, oh, no, we need to track it. This show is talking about diversity. So get out there and go do it. That's been amazing.
Let me ask you about this, because your production company, speaking of diversity and just giving other people platforms and showing stuff, you're doing a special on Rosa Parks first. That's dope. Why her? And why now? And when do you think we'll be able to see it? And then, like, I'm going to ask you for a favor because I need a Fannie Lou Hamer doc, too. So I'm just going to throw that out there for you, okay?
We are going to be able to see it in February, I believe. And, I can't believe there was never a Rosa Parks doc. There's a fantastic book about Rosa Parks that actually, you know, I think there's a lot of mythology around Rosa Parks. You know, she's meek and quiet and just didn't want to get out of her seat. When my daughter was in elementary school, she came home and said, Rosa Parks wouldn't get on the bus. I'm like, what? She wouldn't get on the bus. I'm like, what are you talking about? But in a way, I mean, obviously totally wrong, but people, you know, they know these one-liners, right? Rosa Parks wouldn't give up her seat. Rosa Parks was tired. Well, there's a lot more to Rosa Parks than that. Rosa Parks was pretty much a badass when it came to being an activist. Yes. And what she did for her entire life before what she did on the bus afterwards. So she has an incredible life story to share. We're really excited about that project that's going to air on Peacock. And then Fannie Lou Hamer, I'm going to work on that for you. I think that would be amazing. Actually, I think that, that would be incredible. We can get that going. And then we got a project I was going to say we have a project that's going to air on
HBO. I was getting to that because you have Black and Missing. I can't think of a more timely topic. Talk to us about that special. And I asked Tamron Hall a similar question because she has an amazing new book out. And you know, we know the lack of reporting on missing Black people is a problem, and we know why. And there seems to be no appetite to fix it. Why is that?
Well, I think the structures that make it what it is, there's not a huge incentive to change it. So I remember being in the newsroom when Lacey Peterson went missing. It was Christmas. I was at NBC News. Someone ran in and said, hey, there's this girl that's missing. She was cute. She had her dog was missing, you know, remember her dog came home. I mean, it had all the elements and it literally is summed up by, are you attractive? Are you going to be attractive to our audience? Could there be an interesting backstory? You know, Christmas in a way, as sick as this sounds, was the silver lining of it, right? It was something that happened. And when Lacey Peterson went missing, many other people went missing too. But in a lot of cases, I think the people who sort of assess who's going to be good TV, you know, they don't necessarily feel like that story is appealing to them. And there's a lot, as you know, that's woven into that. Yeah. Young Black women are seen as more mature. Often even law enforcement thinks of them as, well, they're runaways, which is, if you're underage, people should be worried about you running away anyway. And so I think sometimes there's a reluctance from law enforcement's perspective, even from the community, the women at Black and Missing Foundation who we profiled. You know, even they said, like, sometimes the community isn't up in arms. And, you know, it's a virtuous circle, right? Which is, media gets mad. That means that the law enforcement feels the pressure, so they have to do more. Well, if the community gets mad, they pressure the media to get mad, that pressures the law enforcement, you know. But if nobody's mad, if nobody's outraged, if nobody feels like, hey, these are important people, these people matter. And we're in a society where, listen, I can't imagine if one of my kids went missing. I mean, I whenever any parent has to get up there in front of a camera and say, you know, if you're listening to us, I hope you will, you know, it's awful. It's awful. But I do sometimes feel like there's a world that cares about their kid. And for a lot of the young women who are Black and missing, or women of color and missing, there's just a sense that people just don't care that much about their children.
Tell me about your show, Black and Missing. What's different about it, other than the fact we get a chance to see it? But talk to me a little bit about how you were able to actually sell it.
We brought it to HBO. We were very interested. It took us about 3 years. So it's funny because you said the timing is right. I'm like, oh my gosh, the timing unfortunately is always right. I mean, right? We could have done this a year ago.
That's evergreen, right? Yeah.
Probably evergreen. So I think HBO was very interested. We got access to the women who run the Black and Missing Foundation. And, you know, it's always hard when you do a doc because you have to really camp out with people and show the work that they do very much on the ground. They started getting awards a lot of times in Black press, or Black Girls Rock had just awarded Derica and Natalie, the two who run this foundation. But we were very interested in seeing, like, how are they doing what seems impossible to me, right? Move the media, move law enforcement, and really move communities to care. It's a lot. And there's such... you know, they're such hard workers and they're really amazing women. And I think they just bring a lot of hope to people who feel like absolutely, you know, they're shouting into the wind that people don't care about their loved ones.
Well, Soledad O'Brien, thank you for all the work that you have done. Thank you for all the work that you are doing. And I challenge you, because thank you for all the work that you will do. You've always been a hero for so many of us. And thank you for joining the Bukhari Sellers podcast. This is dope. This is an honor of mine. Yeah.
Nice to see you. Thank you for having me.
Before I let you go, I wanted to shout out Beto O'Rourke for announcing this week that he'll be challenging Greg Abbott in 2022. We'll play the launch video.
It's a really small vision for such a big state, but it doesn't have to be that way. And I know that together we can get back to being big again, because I saw that in February when the electricity grid failed and those in power failed all of us. It was the people of Texas who were willing to put their differences behind them and get to work doing the job at hand, which meant helping our fellow Texans get through that crisis. We did this out of a sense of duty and responsibility to one another. Now imagine if the governor of Texas felt that same way.
Now, this is one of those states in 2022 that we should all be watching. Texas is ground zero for voter suppression, crazy gun laws, and putting women's rights on the chopping block. And any progress that Democrats can make in making Texas less fucking crazy is a win for America. No state does more damage to our politics, in my view, than Texas. Florida's out there, too. Given its size and horribleness of its politicians, whether it be Greg Abbott or Ted Cruz or their horrible lieutenant governor, Florida comes close, but it doesn't even beat Texas. So if you can give a few bucks, share the campaign launch video on your social media timeline. If you can spare a little bit of time, go knock on doors in Texas and support Beto O'Rourke. Now that's that on that. We'll see you guys all on Thursday.